The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will be reading from Good Old Days magazine. Since we have celebrated Independence Day this month, I want to share two articles with you celebrating the holiday. The first is titled, Swinging and Singing for the 4th of July, and this is submitted by Marilyn Ludwig. Climb, climb up Sunshine Mountain, heavenly breezes blow. Climb, climb up Sunshine Mountain, faces all aglow. I sang lustily and proudly as I went back and forth in my swing. It had been such a fine day, starting early when Peggy Shaw and I smashed our paper caps on a perfectly flat rock in the gully. Bang! We had caused our own explosions. Happy 4th of July, we yelled. Did I know what that meant? Not really. It was 1947 and we lived in Anvil Points, a mining camp in western Colorado. I was only 4 years old, almost five. All I knew for sure was that Daddy didn't have to go to work that day, and I would have fun all day long, even way past dark. My little dog, Pal, was confined inside the house. This was not his favorite holiday because of the noise, but after Christmas, I thought it might be mine. I would decide on the 5th of July, an ordinary day when I would have time to decide. My backyard swinging song fest began with me facing south. Our mesa could have been named Sunshine Mountain, especially with the sun shining brightly on it. Daddy said it wasn't really a good climbing mountain. He said it was far away, even though it looked close by. I wanted to go to the mesa because it looked peaceful and green, not rocky and dusty like everything around me. I thought God probably lived there. It would make a good heaven. I wasn't sure whether heaven was a real or pretend place. I decided I'd ask Mommy. She knew more than Daddy about Sunday school things. I wished that nighttime would come. Then everyone in Anvil Points, all 70 families, would take their picnic suppers and fireworks down to the gully. We would share our food with friends before watching others set off fireworks. My family wouldn't have anything exciting like Roman candles, but other people would. And as Daddy said, it doesn't cost anything to watch. I stopped pumping the swing and coasted to a stop. It was time for a new song, facing the other direction, north, way up high. The bear went over the mountain. The bear went over the mountain. The bear went over the mountain to see what he could see. Lucky old bear. He got to see what was on the other side of the pointy cliffs. I wondered if he'd make it to the top. It would be a terribly hard climb and dangerous with all those sharp rocks in places where shell dust didn't slide down. Even the switchback roads that Daddy helped people make were scary. The roads led to the mines, and jeeps and covered trucks were the only things that went up there carrying the miners to work. Someday, I would see the other side. Maybe I'd fly my own airplane. That would be the best way. Marilyn, time to go, sweetie. Mommy and Daddy, carrying baskets, joined me at the swing, and we walked together along a steep path going from our backyard down to the gully. We set up a spot just for us on flat ground, careful to stay away from the tick bushes grown-ups called sagebrush. I was almost too excited to eat sandwiches and drink cherry soda pop, but I found room for marshmallows. I played with my friends, Peggy, Sharon, and Joyce, but I stayed away from Joyce's mean big brother who teased me. Our firecrackers made satisfactory explosions while we waited. Then it was time for the big event. The beautiful, thrilling fireworks, the ones Daddy said were too dangerous for us to have. All the colors, purple, blue, orange, like thousands of small Colorado sunsets filled the sky. I lay back on the blanket and gasp, my mouth open. Whatever the 4th of July was about, it must be very important. I was getting cold and the gnats were starting to bite. A nice older boy, Pat, offered to carry me piggyback up the path while Mommy and Daddy carried our baskets and blankets. I liked Pat a lot, so this was special. Just one more swing ride, I pleaded when we reached our backyard. This time I looked down into the gully at the few fireworks still going off. They were the only lights except those coming from our house. I couldn't even see the mountains, even though the moon was nice and bright. I see the moon sees me, under the shade of the old oak tree. Please let the light that shines on me shine on the one I love. Over the mountains, over the sea, back where my heart is longing to be. Please let the light that shines on me shine on the one I love. With the song ended, I thought, I love lots of people. Please let the light shine on everyone in Anvil Points. Time to come inside, sweetie. Coming. Daddy, why is there a 4th of July? It's our country's birthday, sweetie. I yawned. Happy birthday, country. I've got a second 4th of July story for you, and this is submitted by Donna McGuire Tanner, and is titled Family 4th. On that Friday morning on July 4th, 1952, our home was buzzing with activity. Food was cooking in the kitchen with both breakfast and dinner smells. My mother, Rachel, and my grandmother, Bertha Workman, were cooking what seemed like tons of delicious delights. The night before, Mom had baked her famous banana coconut cake, and I had made potato salad. Now I could smell that Grandma was frying chicken and that a meatloaf had just been taken out of the oven of our coal-burning kitchen stove. As my siblings finished their quick breakfast, I began getting the younger ones dressed in their picnic clothes. My sister Brenda and I waited until the last second to put on our new shorts outfits. Mom packed the food in boxes to keep anything from spilling. My father, Basil, waited to place the boxes in the back of our green Plymouth station wagon. Of course, a big watermelon was already packed. The inside of the car would retain that good picnic smell for days. Why all the hurry and excitement? Next to Christmas, the 4th of July was my family's favorite day. This holiday happened during coal miners' vacations, which meant time off, and not only was my father free, but my uncles on Mom's side of the family were too. We would meet them and their families at a chosen place halfway between where we lived in Warewood, West Virginia, and where they lived in Ridgewood, West Virginia, 100 miles away. Since they lived so far away, we cousins only were able to see each other a few times a year. Our dads always picked where the picnic would be. If we kids were lucky, they would choose a state park where there was playground equipment or hiking trails. In 1952, we found ourselves in the middle of nowhere. It was a piece of cleared land where cows were raised. The food was laid out on tablecloths, but we didn't get to eat. We all grabbed food and ran as fast as we could since we were being chased by several cattle. With heavy hearts and empty stomachs, we started our journey home. We were so sad. After all, it would be another whole year before the 4th of July rolled around again. As we headed home, we came across a little creek. The caravan of cars began driving through it because it wasn't deep. The water barely touched the rim of the tires. Off to one side in the creek was a slightly deeper spot that would allow someone to stand. Suddenly, my father stopped the car and firmly commanded us children to take off our shoes and get out. We knew to mind him. The uncut watermelon was taken out. Mom and my aunts knew how messy we kids could be, so they always packed an extra outfit for each of us. After the melon was sliced, the adults decided where the best place would be to eat it because the juice would soak us from head to toe. The chosen dining place was in the middle of the creek. That last-minute treat was the most fun we kids had ever had. We were full and clean at the same time. Our mothers had dry towels waiting for us. Seemed like moms always knew what to bring on the 4th of July picnic. In honor of man first landing on the moon on July 20th, 1969, I have a story for you entitled Moon Shot, and it is submitted by Paula Shepherd Sheedy. Days before the first moon landing and Neil Armstrong's small step, there was the initial moon shot on July 16th, 1969. I was 18 years old and lived in Indiana. That summer, I visited my Aunt Mimi and cousin Susie, who lived on an orange grove in the country near the town of Christmas, Florida. Yes, famous for their postmark. I'm not sure I knew that the moon shot was going to happen while I was in Florida, but once I arrived, I knew it was. Everyone was getting ready for it. The town of Christmas is located 20-plus miles from the Kennedy Space Center. I was told that land had been purchased for many miles around the launch area because of damage the sound waves could cause to property. Plus, the rivers and intercoastal water would absorb and slow the vibrations of the sound waves. In Christmas, we should feel nothing. The tradition of my aunt and cousin and many other Floridians was to watch the countdown and blast off on TV, and then go outside to watch the real thing until the rocket disappeared into the upper atmosphere. It was always amazing, they told me. The morning of the liftoff finally came. We watched on TV as my aunt and uncle narrated to me what was happening, like they didn't know that we also watched these same launches on TV in Indiana. Finally, the last few seconds arrived. 3, 2, 1, liftoff. There was a huge cloud of white smoke and vapor and an enormous flame. Out of it emerged the Apollo 11 rocket. Then we hurried outside. There it was, bigger than any airplane I had seen in the sky. I could still see the flame. It rose slowly, not rapidly like I expected, for what seemed like several minutes until it was gone from sight. It was as amazing as they had told me. With the excitement of the launch at the end, I decided to take a walk down the sandy country road a mile or so to Susie's house. As I walked, I thought of how impossible the moon trip was. Could they actually land on the moon? Would they be able to return if they got there? What if they couldn't? Would they be stuck? It was surely impossible. As I continued walking, I put it out of my mind to enjoy the peacefulness of my surroundings. It was so quiet. No cars, no people, no noise at all. I was admiring the different plant life while staying alert for any wildlife like snakes and alligators when suddenly the ground started to shake. Telephone poles swayed above me. My balance was being affected, so I got down on my hands and knees. I was scared. What was happening? Was I going to die here? The vibration slowed and then stopped. I had survived. I got up and ran back to Aunt Mimi's house. Was it an earthquake? Had something gone wrong with the moonshot? Had it crashed and caused an earthquake? When I arrived, Aunt Mimi was cleaning up some broken glass. Uncle Chet had neglected to secure the china cabinet doors as warned, and one or more of her precious dishes had fallen out and broken. They also had been surprised by the strength of the sound waves. I told them my story of being on my hands and knees and the dancing telephone poles. We laughed and hugged. She said, "You will never forget this visit," and I haven't forgotten. Our next article is from the Looking Hollywood Way, and it's titled, My Favorite Martian. In 1962, script fixer Sherwood Schwartz, producer and writer for shows like Gilligan's Island and The Brady Bunch, was asked to watch a pilot for a new TV sitcom. Its plot centered on a young newspaper reporter living in California and a Martian anthropologist who had crash-landed after a near-miss encounter with a military aircraft and was stuck on Earth until he could repair his spacecraft. In a 2010 interview, Schwartz said, "To this day, that's the best pilot I ever saw." He went on to say it was a perfect example of a fish-out-of-water storyline, and if it was carried out right, the show My Favorite Martian would easily have a 4 to 5 year run. The fish-out-of-water premise has been used many times in movies and on TV. Many sitcoms of the 1960s employed this plot device. My Favorite Martian had the ultimate fish-out-of-water, a man from another planet, and it presented a situation rife with opportunities for a comedy. In the first episode, the reporter, Tim O'Hara, first thinks he can turn his encounter with the Martian into a story that will win him a Pulitzer Prize. Tim decides it's to his benefit to keep the alien's secret and stumbles on a name for him. He's Martin. That's his name. He's my uncle. Uncle Martin was played by Ray Walston. He lived from 1914 to 2001, and he began his acting career on stage in 1939. He appeared in nearly 40 feature films, including 2 Best Picture Oscar winners, The Apartment of 1960 and The Sting of 1973, and he won 2 Emmys for his work as Judge Henry Bone in the series Picket Fences, which ran from 1992 to 1996. Tim O'Hara was played by Bill Bixby. Born in 1934, Bixby made his TV debut in a 1959 episode of Hennessy, a 3-season show starring Jackie Cooper. His first larger role on the big screen was with Elvis Presley in Clambake in 1967, and he was the lead in Disney's 1975 movie The Apple Dumpling Gang, but the major part of his work was on television. In 1969 to 1972, he starred in The Courtship of Eddie's Father as a widower, raising a young son. Bixby's most successful series was The Incredible Hulk, which ran from 1977 to 1982, in which he played Dr. David Banner. His massive green alter ego was played by bodybuilder Lou Ferrigno. Bixby also directed many episodes of 40 different TV shows from 1970 to 1991. The other major member of the cast was Tim's landlady, Mrs. Brown, portrayed by Pamela Britton, who appeared in 62 of the 107 episodes. Britton was born in 1923 and started her career on stage. She played Blondie Bumstead in the 1954 TV movie and in the 1957 series based on the comic strip Blondie. As it turned out, Sherwood Schwartz's predictions about My Favorite Martian didn't come to pass. It was canceled in 1966 after 3 seasons. Schwartz said they lost their audience after the producers and writers forgot the original fish-out-of-water premise and opted to make Uncle Martin the ally of Tim instead of the other way around. Plus, he thought the writers went wild, going forward and backward in time, giving Uncle Martin the ability to turn himself into a lion, and so forth. Schwartz said, "You have to promise an audience a certain thing when you do a show in comedy, and you should stay in that box. You have to stay true to the original thesis. I couldn't say on Gilligan's Island that they could leave and come back. The thesis is that they are stuck there, and therefore they have to get along with each other. You can never lie to the audience because they won't trust you anymore." That may be the case, but Uncle Martin and his Martian nephew, Andromeda, seen once on the original show, were featured in an animated version in 1973 to 1975 with actor Jonathan Harris, who played Dr. Smith on Lost in Space, voicing the part of Uncle Martin. Also, a big screen movie was made in 1999, And today, audiences can still enjoy reruns of the original TV series. And next, from Good Old Days on Wheels, Cheryl Hoskins Bigelow presents an article titled, Make Noise and Turn Left. My grandson said he didn't understand why I watch NASCAR races. All the drivers do is make noise and turn left, he said. However, listening to the roar of the engines for several hours causes my mind to quit just turning in circles for a while. I challenge anyone to be troubled while admiring the buff drivers and colorful cars. I wonder if other NASCAR fans watching the races at home stand in front of their televisions and place their hands over their hearts as I do while the national anthem is played before the green flag is waved. I don't have a favorite driver anymore, although, heavens to Betsy, there is now a woman on one of the pit crews, so I may tag the driver of her car. I always think I'm glad I'm not that driver's grandma when fate, sometimes disguised as a caution flag during the last lap, dashes a young driver's chance for a win. I see them hang their heads over the roofs of their rides after they pit before standing tall and congratulating the lucky winner. I was never on a pit crew, but I did have a crew member patch with my name on it for the back of my jacket. And I did drive a race car around the track at the home of the Mighty Mites, the Olympia 3/4 Midget Speedway in Washington State. I was supervised by my dad, my uncle, my half-brother, and my boyfriend. I donned a helmet, tightened my seatbelt, and drove the car around the track after the regulation races were over. So I got a feel for how focused a driver must be to safely navigate turning left around the curves. Auto racing was part of my family's culture in the mid-1950s, every Friday night from the first week in June until the end of August, and the championship race. My dad, Bud Hoskins, drove one of the cars after a week of rushing to repair any damage from the previous race. My boyfriend, who took auto shop in high school, spent more hours in our garage polishing and tricking out the car every week than he did sitting by me on our couch and trying to steal a kiss. He got to be on the pit crew, but I was invited to be the trophy queen. I wore a fancy dress and lots of lipstick as I sat up on top of the back seat in a vintage convertible. Circling the track, I waved to the crowd until we reached the starting line. The driver who won that day was a handsome, dark, curly-haired fellow that would make my 15-year-old girl's heart throb. I handed him the trophy and shyly waited for at least a cheek brush, but I didn't receive the kiss and honeymoon hug I had witnessed previous trophy queens enjoy. Later, the winner told fellow racers that he wouldn't kiss me because of my age, and also because my dad, my uncle, my half-brother, and my boyfriend were watching. Jennifer Heth submits our next story, Learning to Toil the Soil. It's amazing when I think back to how my fascination with gardening began when I was just 8 years of age in the 1970s. The cheery sun was peeking over the horizon, and there was a nip in the air. It was a breezy Saturday in March. My father had spring fever and was out in the garage making his list of necessary tools and supplies he would need for tending to the yard. Dad said I could ride with him downtown to visit Cookson's Hardware Store. Early morning Saturday trips to downtown Howard, Kansas were always an adventure. Once in a blue moon, I might catch sight of some of my good friends who lived out in the country and had come to town with their parents, too. We pulled in front of Cookson's with its fancy window displays and entered the store. Dad went over to get assistance with purchasing parts for his mower, while I began walking the aisles and gazing at all the items neatly lining each store shelf. From the corner of my eye, I spied a brightly colored spinning kiosk of vegetable and flower seeds. My eyes grew big with curiosity. The only experience I had with gardening was when Mom and Dad had endeavored to plant a tiny plot at our previous home. Between the drought and my mom's disinterest with the whole idea, we ended up with several cherry tomatoes and not much else. They didn't know it yet, but things were about to change. I began picking out seed packets, tomatoes, watermelon, cucumbers, and more. My mouth began to water as I thought about the fresh produce I was going to grow. I was determined to contribute to our family's needs. I might have been small in stature, but I was stubborn and strong. If I put my mind to something, I wouldn't stop until I saw it through. I ran up to the counter and purchased these seeds packets with my weekly allowance. When Dad and I arrived at home, Mom was standing in the kitchen washing dishes. I excitedly burst through the back screen door and began pulling seed packets out of my shopping bag while explaining how I was going to plant a garden behind the garage. Mom sternly looked over at Dad as he walked into the house. Well, long story short, after showing Dad my seed packets while talking a mile a minute about it being fully my project, Dad caved in and said he would help. That afternoon, Dad and I began tilling a chosen plot behind our garage. Dad gave me full responsibility for caring for our family garden that summer. Pulling weeds and watering the garden wasn't that bad, in all honesty. My prize was picking those delicious red tomatoes and vegetables fresh off the vine and knowing my hard work had put food on our dinner table. There is nothing better than a delicious BLT and mayo sandwich served with ice-cold cucumber salad on a hot summer day. With the Olympics starting at the end of July, here's a little fun fact for you. In the 1920s, Johnny Weissmuller won 5 Olympic gold medals and 1 bronze in swimming categories. In 1950, he was selected as the greatest swimmer of the first half of the 20th century by the Associated Press. In his movie career, which ran from 1929 to 1976, he played Tarzan 12 times and Jungle Jim 14 times. Can you guess the year? Kathy's Clown, performed by the Everly Brothers, becomes a number one hit. The new 50-star United States flag is officially flown. The television show, My Three Sons, starring Fred McMurray, debuts. Do you know the year? It was 1960. We have run out of time for today's episode of Good Old Days. Be sure to tune in next time, and we hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Good Old Days is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. And again, that number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.